Let's get started today. Welcome to today's Employment Law 101. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We are based in the south of England, but help businesses that are all over the world. They have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. I am delighted, as ever, to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning, morning, everybody.
And it's a very beautiful, sunny South Oxfordshire that we're joining you from today. Isn't it glorious at the moment?
Yeah, it's far too nice to be at work, frankly.
It is far too nice. Or to have the stress of computer reboots about a minute before a webinar is due to start, which is what I experienced this morning. Just a couple of housekeeping points before we get into today's session. It is being recorded. Those of you who are long-standing joiners will know you can get our recordings on the MPM Legal website, where you can see a full video and audio recording. And of course, we've got all of the audio recordings on Spotify, Amazon Music, and Apple as well. We've got something like 65 episodes on there now for you to go back through and find a topic of interest, because there's something for everybody. But in terms of what we are talking about today, it's all about cost cutting and the employment law risks associated with that. I anticipate we're going to have quite a few questions. So, as ever, benefit of you joining live today is you get to answer your question, ask your questions, and we'll do our best to answer them in the time we've got. If you want to ask questions, please just use the Q&A function that's down at the bottom toolbar. That just helps us to manage them. And I have now enabled the chat function. So if anybody just wants to comment on anything or chat to the other participants, then use the chat function for that. Both should be accessible to you. So we, of course, have had the news yesterday about the US Liberation Day imposition of tariffs, set against quite a challenging economic backdrop, it's fair to say, anyway. And we know that a lot of organizations at the moment are looking at reorganizations. They're considering redundancy exercises, really, as employers feel the pinch with those rising costs. I just mentioned the tariffs we've got. Of course, this month sees the rise in employers' national insurance contributions as well. Other costs are rising. And I mean, we've not even got onto our favorite hot topic at the moment, which is the Employment Rights Bill and the addition of red tape, an extra layer of cost that brings as well. What we wanted to do today was just walk through and talk through some of the common questions we get asked when it comes to redundancy exercises. Obviously, between us, we've got a heck of a lot of experience, and we like to think we've covered pretty much every conceivable scenario. We can't promise we're going to cover every single thing today in the 30 minutes or so that we've got available, but we're going to give it our best shot, aren't we, Adrian?
We will.
So, first question, start at the beginning, which seems like a good place to go from. Often we'll get involved where phone rings and, hey, we're going through a change process. We need some help with redundancy. Now, the first question we're going to ask is, well, let's look to see if it is actually a redundancy situation, because it might not be. And it's an important point. It can be overlooked sometimes. But what we need to look at is the statutory definition of redundancy, which is in fact very specific. And you basically have three main categories that trigger redundancy obligations. So the first is a business is closing down. So if you imagine a chain of supermarkets and the entire supermarket chain decides to close. The second is a particular workplace closing down, so a branch of the supermarket in my example. And then the third limb is if there's diminished requirements for the business for employees to do work of a particular kind. And there are a couple of subsets that are associated with that. So just sticking with my supermarket example, one way it could be triggered is the supermarket decides to part automate some elements within the in-store bakery. So they don't need as many bakers as they've got within store. That can trigger redundancy. And of course, if you stretch that further, if the entire bakery system becomes automated and the supermarket says, hey, we don't need to employ bakers full stop, then you need fewer bakers within the organization, and that's going to trigger redundancy as well. Now, I know pretty much all of you will be aware of those categories. The first two are pretty straightforward in most cases, but for us, it's the third one which creates either some difficulties Or if you want to spin it around and look at it in a positive way, it maybe gives you some options in terms of how you run things. Now, in terms of the focus that you're going to have, you might be altering the focus of an employee's job. You could be changing the duties that the employee needs to do, or you might be looking at changing other terms and conditions of employment. Now, depending on those specific circumstances, those things could well be a redundancy situation if your business objective fits into that third category of there being a diminished requirement for your staff to do work of a particular kind. And that's important because that gives rise to the need to consult on redundancies. All of the legal obligations regarding redundancy kick in, and you need to be able to go through that process to give yourself a shot of defending an unfair dismissal case if it all goes wrong at the end. Equally, though, I guess the flip side to that is it could be that there isn't actually a diminishing need. And really, what you've got is a reorganization leading just to a change in terms and conditions of employment. And we do see this quite a lot. There are a lot of cases on this, and I'm talking about employment tribunal claims, where employers have said, look, what we were doing here wasn't a redundancy situation. It was a reorganization, but it fell short of meeting the statutory definition of redundancy. And the employers have found to be acting unreasonably in refusing to accept the changes. Of course, the dispute in that case, in those cases, is going to be over entitlement to redundancy pay. So
This is
really,
quite. I just want to jump in there because I think I've got an example off the top of my head. So, for example, if you've got, say, you're reorganizing your sales territories, is something that we get involved in quite often. You've got a number of, geographically based field sales reps. It might be that you're rejigging the territory. Say you've got five reps. You're rejigging the territories, but you still need five reps. Now, does that give rise to a redundancy situation? Well, a lot of the time, this is going to be fact based and very specific. But if it's a question of you're just moving the boundaries and you still require the employees to do their jobs, but you're rejigging those territories, then that's going to more likely be a reorganization. If, however, you're rejigging the territories and that results in going from five to four, for example, then that's more likely to be a redundancy. But there are bits in between. So, it could be that you end up facing an argument that there's no longer a requirement for an employee who's based in a particular region, for example, and that requirement is going. You might pull out of that particular territory, and arguably that's then a redundancy, even if you still need five reps, with the aim that those five would just be allocated to different territories. So you can see how it's very fact specific, but it's worthwhile thinking about this up front. I just thought I'd chuck that in
No,
there
I mean, it's absolutely right. So, I
as an
mean,
example.
I can think of several conversations, I've had in the last 12 months where something has started, it's progressed as a redundancy consultation. And when we've actually dug into it, it isn't, it falls short of that. It's more just like a reorg. Now, practical difference, it may not matter if the employer is still willing to offer something equal to a stat redundancy payment and there's some kind of severance package. But equally, there are situations where if it's economic reasons that's driving it and the employer can't afford to pay any more than absolutely necessary, whereas actually doesn't have to pay a stat redundancy payment after all. So I guess the fundamental point with this one is think, I mean, it sounds like a super obvious basic point, but still think carefully from the start. Can you simply discuss with the employee about change in terms of a reorg, or are you actually getting into a warning of redundancies and triggering the whole consultation process? So in terms of that consultation, what about kicking that off, Adrienne?
Yeah, so the question we get asked is, when should we start consulting? Now, obviously, if we're talking about collective consultation, then everybody knows that you've got sort of a minimum period. It's actually a pause, isn't it, on dismissals for a period of either 30 or 45 days, but everybody knows it as the consultation period of a minimum of 30 or 45 days. But the question often comes up is, when is that duty actually triggered? And for collective consultation, so where you've got 20 or more impacted, it really does, it's triggered before a firm decision is made. And that's because you need to consult over the business reasons for the redundancy in the first place. Trade union reps, employee reps need to be involved in that process because there's little point in consulting collectively when the decision has already been made and it's presented as a fait accompli. And that was a case many years ago which said that the consultation needs to be over the actual business reasons. Now, in reality, what normally happens is an employer has a pretty good idea of, what needs to be done. But I guess the strict technical position is that, you know, the earlier you start consulting when you're proposing this, when you're thinking about it, the better, because the reps have to have the chance to put forward their views on avoiding redundancies. But it has to be more than just the employer thinking that redundancies might be needed. So if it's a case of, well, we've got to look at cost cutting, we're going to need to reduce headcount, you know, that's probably not enough. It needs to be a bit more fleshed out than that. So you can see that this is a really super fine line in terms of making that decision. Because if you're only sort of thinking about cost cutting, you may not even know how many people might be potentially impacted. So how do you know whether or not that threshold of 20 or more is triggered? So, you know, that's kind of the situation on the collective. For less than 20, it is slightly different because a decision will have been made that redundancy is needed and consultation will be over the proposal to make that individual's role redundant. Now, that, of course, leads to the consultation process over things like the pooling, the selection criteria, the scores that will be applied, and, of course, whether or not there are ways to avoid redundancy by looking at alternative roles. But in this case, the earlier you consult, the fairer it will be. And certainly tribunals have, I was kind of looking at case law, and tribunals are really unhappy about sort of a rushed process. So if, for example, consultation is we're going to cram two meetings into a week, it's going to look like that you've paid sort of lip service to the process, and then that it's not fair. I mean, I think what I would say on this is, although everybody's used to let's put employees at risk, let's have consultation meetings, let's do all of this, there is actually no statutory designated process on a redundancy. It goes back to the same broad principles for unfair dismissal, i.e., has there been fairness when it comes to the dismissal? So if you are allowing time for employees to reflect on the position, you're taking on board the points during the consultation meeting, and you're doing that over a period of time, then that's going to lend you, you know, a lot more credence to the fact that you're treating people fairly. Now, I would just add on this that very often the boot's on the other foot, and the employees get really unhappy that they're put at risk and then their first consultation meeting isn't for 4 days because they want to get on with it. You're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't. But I think ultimately I'd rather endure the wrath of the employee in that sense to explain why that you're following that process, particularly if, you know, you're dealing with a lot of people and you might not be that that resource heavy in terms of having the meetings.
Yeah, I see that more in collective consultation situations where you get a sense from the employees that they just want to get on with it. But obviously, yeah, you can comply with all the TULCRA requirements there.
Yeah.
In terms of how long the consultation period should last then, do you need to tell the employees about length of time? That's something else we get asked about as well. Again, talking here just about individual consultations and not when collective consultation is engaged. It is a good idea to help manage expectations. Now, you don't want to set yourself up to fail, so you don't want to be too punchy in terms of what you're saying. But I think managing expectations by setting out at the outset how long you think consultation is going to last is a good thing. Now, I guess it's sensible to caveat it. You don't know what's going to come out of the consultation process. And certainly, I mean, to your point, Adrienne, if it's an exercise where you've got multiple selections, for example, there's scope for a longer consultation period there because you may well be consulting on what criteria you're going to use, how those criteria are applied. You go away, do the scoring, and then there may be some follow-up discussions around how you have actually scored. And that's naturally going to stretch that process out. So that is going to be different than if you've got, you know, three people in three standalone roles where you're looking at making three redundancies because you're not necessarily making a selection there. So there isn't a hard and fast rule. It just does come back to general fairness in terms of time scale. And if genuinely you can have several meetings in a couple of weeks and you're doing that meaningful consultation, so you're listening, you're going away, you're thinking about counter proposals, you're responding to them, that's all fine. Equally, it can be longer. I guess there are disadvantages to it being too long. You know, this point we just mentioned about employees feeling like they just want to get on with it. Some will just want the finality of a decision so they can go on and plan their life accordingly. But if it takes longer, so be it.
Just one thing on that as well. The one thing that we come across quite a lot, and in actual fact, this comes up more when we're acting for individuals, for example, who might have been offered a settlement agreement. We sit on the other side of the fence as well from time to time. And very often what will happen is there will be a very set meeting timetable, consultation meeting one, consultation meeting two. But then, of course, when it comes to suitable alternative employment, employees may well have made applications for the alternative roles. And sometimes people come a cropper because they say, well, I've just been invited to my final consultation meeting where I've been told that notice might be given to me, but I'm still in an interview process for an alternative role. So, for example, that's where you need a bit of flex, because obviously you can't confirm redundancy if somebody is in the mix for a job, because you know, if they're in the mix for a job, they need to make sure that there's a decision to be made. And it's only when a decision is made, then you can really decide the next step, i.e., redundancy has been avoided because they've been successful in getting another job, or unfortunately, they've not been successful in getting another job, in which case then those options are exhausted. So, I mean, I think it's incredibly difficult because very often a lot of the timetable is driven by finance considerations or other business considerations. And in terms of being the sort of like the HR team trying to manage it upwards, I think that's probably a point that sometimes gets forgotten.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
There's
Just
another
in
one though,
terms
isn't it? Sorry,
of
I
that
was just going to
again.
say this is sort of like the next question. It kind of leads quite nicely into the next question. So something
About
else then could perhaps derail your timetable a little bit, or not
voluntary
necessarily derail.
redundancies
Yeah, is
and
you know, we
packages.
get asked, should we offer voluntary redundancy? Now, obviously, offering voluntary redundancy is great for the employees because you're empowering them to make the decisions. It's going to cut down on an awful lot of potential dispute if they feel like they can go, right, I'll throw my hat into the ring. This is my choice. I'd like to go for a voluntary redundancy. And certainly, as I said, when we sit on the other side of the fence advising employees, the happier ones are the ones that come to us and go, yeah, it's fine. I'm taking voluntary. I want to go. It's not a problem. So, you know, that it's a good thing to consider. There's no legal requirement for you to offer it, but you know, it can be a good thing. And generally, it can be a good thing when, frankly, putting it bluntly, you don't really mind who stays and who goes. But if you're in a position where you want some control over the selection process to ensure that you don't lose, you know, people with a wealth of experience that you might need going on, then it can be a real double-edged sword. You know, and a lot of employers will say, well, we'll offer voluntary, but we reserve the right to obviously reject the application for voluntary. You've got then got to consider some kind of the employee relations piece. You've got somebody who's clearly put their hand up and said, I'd like to go. You say, no, terribly sorry, we want to stay. What are you going to do then to incentivize them to stay? Because they could be then deeply unhappy. And you know, potentially, you've got somebody who's unwilling to stick around. So there's kind of that's the risk, I think, in terms of voluntary.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the other thing that I see with VR processes is the employer not considering using settlement agreements when it's paying quite a substantial enhanced package. And obviously, the risk there is the individual takes the package, takes some money, doesn't give a waiver of claims, and the business is still exposed to the risk of unfair dismissal and, you know, any other myriad of claims as well. So, I
Yeah, because
think.
people change their minds, don't they?
Yeah, I think it is legitimate from the business side that if you're paying an enhanced package, you want to get some value back for that, you know, a bit of quid pro quo.
Yeah.
So also consider the settlement agreements. There are ways of building efficiencies to doing that. So, you know, we've worked on loads of exercises where it's been, you know, 100, 150 individuals that are signing settlement agreements, and there is a process that you can do to make that very cost effective and make it really efficient as well. So don't be put off if you're thinking, well, there are just too many employees that are impacted, and we don't want to be dealing with 150 different employment lawyers all asking for a £1,000 plus VAT legal fee contribution when we've offered 250 quid. So just
Or
bear that in mind.
variations of the settlement agreement, or
Yeah.
yeah,
Dangerous
exactly.
Claude.
Yeah.
Okay, so another absolute hot topic we get asked about all the time is selection criteria. And we could probably do a whole dedicated webinar on selection criteria. We may be pleased to know that we're not going to do that. But in about the next 60 seconds, I will tell you that there are no set criteria to be used. So there isn't a kind of statutory mandated criteria. But the principles are that really criteria should be as objective as possible and capable of verification. Now, what does that mean in practice? Well, can you measure them and can you justify your scoring? So sometimes it's really easy. You know, if you're looking at things like data-driven criteria like call completion rates, call conversion rates, sales figures, they're very easy to measure and they're very easy to justify because often the figures speak for themselves. You know, you can pull raw data and it can be analyzed. Performance ratings can be useful as well, but the sticking point with that is always, has there been a proper performance appraisal system? And I totally appreciate there'll be a range of organizations represented on this call that have a whole host of different approaches to appraisals, from no, we don't do them at all, right through to yes, we have a super structured appraisal process and we get into this quarterly and it's all very well documented. If you haven't got a sophisticated appraisal process and you want to use performance, and you've got to do your best to assess it, but you need to have examples to back up the decision. And again, stuff that's as measurable as possible if you're challenged on it. Other things you can do to help with that process is also having more than one manager to carry out the assessment to avoid any inference of bias, or building in some sort of moderation method to it. So again, you've got more than one pair of eyes looking at scorings, especially in a larger scale exercise where you might want to get that consistency of approach across teams. That becomes really important. Disciplinary records, they're a good criteria to go for, but in our experience, it's often the case that all employees will have a clean record anyway. Then you're into the realms of looking at attendance records. Yes, you can look at attendance as a criteria. It's not problematic. However, you of course have to watch out for disability related absences. And really, you should be discounting any disability related absences to avoid the spectre of disability discrimination claims. So that can get a little bit sticky.
I think that's a really difficult one,
I
given
do.
the sort of the sort of like mental health issues that people are facing when, you know, somebody might be off with stress or anxiety and depression, and nobody's particularly clear on whether or not that actually counts as a disability at the time. And I think a lot of employers are steering away from that, you know, for that reason, because it is quite problematic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, talking of problematic criteria, when you start to move away from the measurable stuff, that's, you know, kind of what makes us wince a little bit. So things like potential to progress, or I mean, we see pretty
Value
naughty
to the
things like value to the
organisation.
organization's cultural fit,
Yeah.
which brings its own risks as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are cases which have supported the use of those types of criteria, but you need to show it's been fairly applied, supported by evidence, which again brings that degree of objectivity in to show exactly how it was applied. Now, remember, going back to some of the early questions we had, it is a very good idea to present the proposed selection criteria at an early stage in the consultation process to get the employees' feedback. So, if you have the luxury of time and planning with these exercises, you'll tell the employees in advance of scoring the criteria that you're going to score them against, get their feedback, and then score. Now, it gives the employees a point of engagement, it makes them feel involved in the process, it gives them some agency, and it helps head off challenges, because if you score and then somebody's selected, you're in the consultation meeting with them, they're not going to be able to say, well, gosh, that was a complete surprise using that criteria. I had absolutely no idea. Why have you taken this into account? And why have you scored me this when actually, you know, the data that you've used is incorrect? You're going to flush out those sorts of issues or head them off completely if you're talking to your employees about the selection criteria in advance. Now, we both know that there are plenty of exercises where the employer just scores, then proceeds with the individuals who have been scored already by placing them at risk. So back to front. You can get away with doing it that way. I've seen plenty of exercises that do it that way, but it isn't ideal. And I think if you're looking at black letter law, it's probably not recommended either in terms of doing things like that.
You might do that though if you know that you're offering a severance package, for example. So
And you got the ability to buy your way out of trouble.
yeah, exactly. So coming on from what about last in, first out? We get
LIFO.
asked this one. Yeah, LIFO. I mean, this used to be super common in terms of criteria, but it went out of favor after the risk of age discrimination was highlighted. But it doesn't mean it can't be used. We tend to say use it as a tiebreaker. So go back to the performance ratings, your disciplinary records, your attendance records. Say that they're all pretty even. All other things are equal in terms of your criteria. Well, how do you make the decision? Well, it is open to you to use LIFO as a tiebreaker, but you've also got to think about the age discrimination piece, which can be justified. But for example, if you go, oh no, we're definitely not using LIFO, have you done an assessment of whether or not those at risk are all of different ages? Is there actually a live risk there? Because if you're looking at a group of people that are broadly the same age, then the risk of age discrimination is going to be pretty low. So you might be able to use it. There is an example of where LIFO was justified, and that was a case that one of the objectives of the exercise was achieving stability of the workforce under very difficult circumstances, and looking at it as a reward for loyalty. So while on the face of it, LIFO could have been discriminatory on age grounds, in this case, the employer was able to say, "We thought about it. These are our business reasons, and we can demonstrate that it's justifiable to meet our business objectives." So don't rule it out. Treat it with some care, but there may be occasions where it's appropriate to use it.
Another topic we get asked about is suitable alternative employment. Do we have to offer a higher level or a lower level job? What counts? So we're talking about this in terms of general fairness of redundancy rather than in relation to the special rules applied to people who are protected because they've taken maternity leave or other family leave. As you know, one of the critical parts of consultation is to look to see if you can redeploy an individual into a suitable alternative role. Suitable means it's broadly a job that's at the same level, it's on the same terms and conditions. But we appreciate that's not always going to be the case. And sometimes you're going to have a role that's more senior or more junior than the individual is performing currently. So starting with a junior role, yes, it may not be suitable, but the mistake to make is just assuming that an employee is not going to be interested in that lower level role. Somebody faced with the prospect of losing a job may prefer to stay employed with you in a lower level role or a junior role rather than to have to go out into the job market and find something else. So it's safest to offer it anyway and let the employee decide whether or not they want to accept it. So you put the ball in their court. In terms of more senior roles, can be a bit trickier because there you've got to assess whether the employee's got the skill set to do that role, and that's not always easy. If they don't, and you can support that decision though, then you're not going to be obliged to offer it. But what you might do is think about offering a trial period during which time you can train them if that would do the trick. So that does take us on to trial periods, Adrienne.
Yeah, I think someone's asked about trial periods as well. So, right. So, one of the typical questions, well, it's not really so much a question we get asked, but we certainly see it in redundancy processes, is employers offering a longer trial period than the statutory 4 weeks. So, if you, first of all, I suppose I should say that the purpose of a statutory trial period is to give the employee and the employer, so both parties, the chance to see if the new role fits and it works out. That's for 4 weeks, which starts on the end of the original contract. If it doesn't work out, then the employee reverts to being redundant. And in terms of calculating the statutory redundancy pay, it's the date when their original contract would have ended. That is the calculation date. So if they roll over in the trial period to another complete year of service, you don't take account of that. But that only applies to the statutory trial period. It can be extended, and there's no limit on how long it can be extended for, but it is in extremely limited circumstances. And that is only where it's extended for the purposes of training the employee so that they can be successful in that new role. So, but many employers will offer a longer period, maybe 3 months or a month or sorry, a couple of months, something like that. And that takes you outside the statutory trial period. And the impact of that is simply that you have to recalculate the statutory redundancy period payment. Getting my words
I
muddled
think
up today.
kind of what happens in practice has become really detached from that legal framework in my experience. Because, for example, I think for the stat trial period to apply, you need to have served or given notice of redundancy under the old role. And that normally doesn't happen in my experience. Normally there's
No.
discussion about let's try you in this other role, and notice isn't actually served in the old role. So there
Yeah.
are some pitfalls to watch out for where you might inadvertently have created what's called a common law trial period rather than a statutory one. But more about that another day. Another really tricky area we get asked about is what if an employee just refuses to come to a redundancy consultation meeting? What can you do there? Well, ultimately, you might get to the point where you have to make your decisions without their involvement, but certainly you don't start at that point. Otherwise, you're going to be in trouble. First of all, find out why they won't come. You know, there might be a health issue. They might be anxious about coming in. They might just be really angry and not have kind of reasonable
Yeah,
grounds for
just
saying
being
no. But
difficult. Yeah.
communication points, find out why don't they want to come, try and encourage them to come along. And if there are some obvious barriers that you can alleviate, like holding a meeting at a neutral venue, holding the meeting on Teams instead of in person, letting them be accompanied by somebody else other than a colleague or trade union rep, particularly if it's disability related, because that could be an adjustment, then just think about those practical steps. Remember though, I mean, the ACAS code of practice, and so the right to be accompanied to redundancy meetings, consultation meetings, doesn't apply technically. Although, I don't know, I think every client that I can think of will permit an employee to be accompanied to a consultation meeting.
I think
Well,
tribunals have come to expect that now.
I think
Look at, you
absolutely,
know,
yeah, I
starting
think
at
they
the end
do.
point, it's an easy give. So, you know, you can have the technical argument, no, we're not letting you bring somebody with you, but then the tribunals would, they might even factor it into the fairness of the process, you know,
Yeah, I think
particularly as
so.
you said, if you've got a vulnerable employee.
Alternatives to having an actual meeting is to do consultation in correspondence. Obviously, it's going to slow things down a little bit, but you can do consultation in writing as an alternative. That could be an adjustment for someone who's neurodiverse, for example, or certainly giving points of discussion in advance of an in-person consultation meeting. If all else fails, you can warn the individual it's in their best interest to attend for the consultation process. But if they don't, then the decision might be made in their absence. But really, that's a last resort for us.
Yeah, absolutely. But the difficulty arises, isn't it, when somebody digs their heels in and generally doesn't want to come and it holds up the process for everybody else, which is always very difficult. Obviously, we're talking about a situation where ultimately that employee might be the one who's leaving rather than the one whom, you know, might be given an alternative role, in which case you can handle that very differently because you can give them some form of comfort subject to consultation with the others in the pool. Another question we get asked, and I appreciate we're going a little bit over time, so apologies if our rate of talking speeds up in order not to take you away from the rest of your day. But the question we get asked, when can we recruit after redundancies? Whew, right. Well, this one for me is a little bit of a red flag, depending on when the question is asked, but obviously it happens, right? So, I mean, I would just say that it's really important to follow the right process for the potentially fair reason for dismissal. Now, the reason I'm saying that is if in your heads you're asking the question of when can we re-recruit at the same time as making redundancies, then very often we're looking at something that may not be a genuine redundancy. A lot of people would prefer to deal with termination for performance reasons on the grounds of redundancy, on the basis that it's meant to be easier than managing performance. Now, managing performance is undoubtedly tricky and confrontational and uncomfortable for everybody. And it can take a long time, right? So, because it could be that you're into a 3-month performance management process. But just because you switch labels and go for redundancy doesn't mean that it will be easier. It might be quicker, but it is fraught with traps. So think carefully before you do this, because unless you're entering into a settlement agreement, it could come back to bite you. But in answer to when can we re-recruit? Well, obviously, we're looking at you know, a limitation period of is 3 months from fair dismissal. Maybe add on another month for the mandatory early conciliation process through ACAS. So you might think, well, if we wait 4 or 5 months, we'll probably be okay. But you haven't factored into that the employment tribunal system. So, and it also may be that an employee who goes to ACAS and says, hey, I think I've got a claim, ACAS will say to them, do you want me to contact the employer? It's open to the employee to say, no, don't bother. I want to go straight to tribunal, in which case ACAS will tick the box. And the first you know about any of this is when the claim lands. And frankly, that can be quite some months later. And we've known claims that have been submitted within the required limitation period that maybe have landed on our desk, say, 6 or 7 months later, even
Oh,
later
yes.
than that. You know, ET claims that get lost. You know, so I don't think that you can rely on a very short window of opportunity. So what can you do? Well, if your business needs have genuinely changed, and you know, it may be you made redundancies because you lost a big contract, you can't support that staff. But say, you know, 3 weeks after that, you land a big contract, all your employees have been made redundant, but you now need to re-resource pretty quickly, then you're going to need to have that evidence to support that there has been a change in the business fortunes. And that will help you then defend the claim that there wasn't a genuine redundancy in the first place. One of the things to watch out for potentially is that if you've got employees on garden leave or during their notice periods, they're still employed by you, and the obligation to look for suitable alternative employment continues right up until the day they leave. So, you know, again, if they haven't signed settlement agreements, there's potential there that you would have to offer them or go back to talk to them and say, hey, you might be in your notice period, but actually enroll has come up. So it's something to watch out for, but it all comes down to the evidence of your business reasons.
Finish with survivors.
The survivors. Yeah. This is something, isn't it, that tends to get overlooked. And we do kind of see this. So say, for example, you've had to slash your workforce. The workload remains the same, but it's for economic reasons. You can't sustain the overheads. So the work's still there. And basically, those that are left over, as Peter calls them, the survivors, are frankly going to have their work cut out because it's going to be down to them to pick up the slack. Is that something that you factored into your process? How are you going to deal with that? Because the flip side of these tough redundancy processes is that you could easily face increased sickness, stress claims, grievances from the remaining employees who say, you didn't talk to us about the impact of these redundancies, and now I've got far too much work to do and I just can't do it. You know, they could easily be hard done by. So have a really serious think at the time when you're planning for people leaving, plan for the people staying.
Yeah, it's quite an easy one to miss that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Equally important. Okay, there are tips. We've had a couple of questions, so let's just have a look at those before we wrap up today's session. By the way, I've also put a link in the chat to our recordings on Spotify. So if you're interested in our session we did last time on neurodiversity in the workplace, and the session before that, which was about avoiding sexual harassment, I think. I should know, but it feels like a long time ago now. Then just check out that link. So somebody's asked, fixed term contract, individual working on a project that's come to an end, there's no further funding, and they've got over 2 years service. Is it a dismissal by redundancy? No other roles available. My insurers will thank me for saying that, obviously, we're not giving specific legal advice, but in general terms, expiry of a fixed term contract can amount to a redundancy dismissal. So expiry of a fixed term contract is a dismissal in law. So it is actionable. If somebody's got over 2 years service or on a fixed term contract, they have the same unfair dismissal rights as any other employee. Sometimes expiries of fixed term contracts will be SOSR, some of the substantial reason. Sometimes they will be a redundancy termination, and it does depend on the individual circumstances. If it's a funding issue and the work's disappearing, that does kind of indicate you're probably more on the redundancy bracket, but it depends, is the perhaps slightly unhelpful answer. But yeah, it can amount to a redundancy, and I would kind of pursue looking at that in a bit more detail. Elaine mentioned about trial periods adding to the redundancy process. I think that was in the context of timescales. Yeah, as we've talked about, absolutely factor in if you're putting in a trial period there, because the clock's still ticking. Again, watch out for whether it's a common law trial period or actually meets the requirements of a statutory trial period, because the implications of what happens regarding statutory redundancy pay do depend on that also. But absolutely factor in the trial periods. I mean, what we'd say generally about these exercises is, we like it best when we're involved in the planning, if you need help with it. But if you're involved in the planning and you're doing the organizational design of it, the planning design for it, that pays dividends multiple times over. Because if you do as much planning as you can, and we're not talking about prejudging outcomes, but you just plan what the process is going to look like from the start, it means when you get into it, you can focus on doing the doing, to use a common phrase, rather than trying to design the process as you're going along. She'll have a lot to juggle. Thanks for those questions. And then finally, when calculating redundancy payment and companies are paying pile-on, is the notice period included when looking at service length? Oh, that comes up quite a bit, doesn't it, Adrienne?
So, I mean, redundancy payments are calculated depending on when the employment ends. So if you've got the contractual right to pay a pile-on, you're terminating with immediate effect, and that's when the employment ends. So any statutory redundancy will be calculated to that date. If you don't have a pile-on, I mean, I've never seen it argued, but people are arguing now that if you don't have the right to pay a pile-on when they're bringing things like wrongful dismissal claims, they're factoring in things like the value of holiday benefits, etc., that would have been paid during the period of notice. But ultimately, no, it's the end date of employment that counts for statutory redundancy. What I have also seen, just when we're doing sort of like these large-scale severance agreements, those types of planning, is that the employers were generally try to be a bit more reasonable and say that if you get another year, you get to another complete year of service within what would have been your notice period, they'll just bump up the redundancy payment to take account of that. And that's very often something. So again, when I'm on the other side of the fence and I'm advising employees, I'm saying they don't have to do that. They've given you an extra year of redundancy when you haven't actually completed it, and it kind of leaves a bit of a nicer taste in the mouth of the employee.
Yeah, I see that quite a bit. I guess it's, how generous and how much goodwill does the outgoing employer want to foster, really? But we see that. Fantastic. Thanks so much for joining today and for your questions as well. Hope you found that session useful. We're going to be back in 2 weeks' time at the same time, so 11 o'clock, if you want to join us live again and ask questions. If not, you can catch it with our recordings on our website and wherever you listen to your podcast. Normally, you just need to search for Employment Law 101. If anybody has any hot topics you would like us to cover in these sessions, then do connect with us on LinkedIn and just drop us a message, and we will gladly take some inspiration. So, anything you'd like us to cover over the coming weeks, please just get in touch. But otherwise, enjoy the sunshine and enjoy the weekend when it arrives. Thanks, everybody.